she would say, tell me the best parts about your day today, or tell me the worst parts about your day. And it required an answer that was more than one word. And, you know, years later, I realized what she was doing. It was wise. It was very wise. And I remember saying to her, I said, why do you ask us that every day? And she said, because if you'll talk to me about the things that really don't matter, you'll talk to me about the things that do.
Yeah, sure. Today, we talked to Jennifer Toomer-Hape. Now, let's talk about this for a second. She was a pastor's kid that moved all around the South and then found the love of her life and moved to, listen to this, Alaska. Goes to Alaska and is a great mom for a long time. Gets divorced and then becomes a real estate agent. Ends up learning the business and just absolutely killing real estate. Wants to get back to her hometown so bad she can't stand it and comes over and takes over a just failing agency here in Birmingham and all the ups and downs that go along with that. The amount of education you will hear about real estate in this episode is astronomical. So if you know a real estate agent, real estate professional, or someone that wants to get into real estate, this is the episode to send them, my episode with Jennifer Toomer-Hape. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. So a little bit of background about Jennifer. I met Jennifer probably 2 years ago when I was doing a lunch over at Keller Williams, Vestavia. She's the broker over there. And I got drawn in to her being from Alaska. And I don't know why that's fascinating to me.
The same reason there's 97 shows on Alaska on TV.
That's exactly right.
It's fascinating.
It's like you guys are another country or you guys are another planet.
That's right.
So the reason I say that is like one of my best friends, Mark Pettis, him and his family, they would take every third or fourth year, they would drive from Alabama to Alaska.
Wow.
Drive for 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
Stay for 10 days. Drive home for 10 days.
Wow.
Every third summer.
So how much therapy do they have to do after this trip?
True. So all that intro, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for being here. She's right across the street, oddly enough.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get enough interaction, but the first question I always ask is, who are you? What do you exactly do, and why does it really matter?
So I'm Jennifer Toomer-Hape, and I serve, and actually I'm not the broker, believe it or not. Our real estate company set up a little bit different than the traditional model.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a broker that works for me. He's phenomenal. We have 476 agents. My title is team leader. That's Keller Williams speak for CEO. So
Now, is it just of this? Was it agency or is this, what would you call it?
Sure, brokerage, yeah.
Just for your brokerage.
That's right. I am.
All the ones, the one in Hoover, the one in Trustful, the one in wherever.
Alabaster, Homewood, Gardendale. Yeah. We're a franchise company.
Yeah.
So we're separately owned and operated, independently owned and operated franchises.
So do you own this one?
I am not an investor in this one. I am in KW Homewood. I have investment in that office that we birthed out of KW Vestavia and launched that in May of 2019.
Why do you not go over there? If you're one of the owners, why do you not go over there and run that one then?
Because I love where I am so much. Now, I do a bunch to help the Homewood office. I teach, I go over, I talk to the team leader. You know, we share systems. You know, we're all separately owned and operated. But
see, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was in Turks in November, and this is all Keller Williams in Turks.
Right.
So somebody, so just like Jason Black, a great friend of mine, owns 8 McDonald's.
Yep, same concept. It's franchise company. Now, we have some common ownership threads. If you laid out the 6 Keller Williams offices in Birmingham, we have some common ownership threads, different people that are in the same ones. However, they are all independent companies. Now, we are sister companies. We play together nicely and all that.
Yeah, sure.
But we are franchises.
That's wonderful. So one of the fascinating things is I think you're from Alaska and people may think that's tell me your background. Growing up,
sure.
About you, your mom and dad, all those things.
Yep. So I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
So I would call Charlotte, North Carolina my home. I lived in Charlotte. I was born there, just lived there a couple months. My father and mother. I was raised by Moses. I'm a preacher's kid.
Did not know that either.
Yeah. So my dad, actually, we just lost my dad in May.
I remember that, yeah.
He's the, thank you. He was the senior pastor at Briarwood Presbyterian Church here in Birmingham, just right down the road.
Yep.
So we lived in Chattanooga, Tennessee for 9 years. Then we moved to Miami, Florida for 3 years. And then, believe it or not, Briarwood Presbyterian Church called my dad to plant a PCA church in Charlotte, North Carolina, our hometown. So at 12 years old, I moved back to Charlotte. So I spent the rest of my time in Charlotte. I went to Charlotte Christian School. I ran track and cross country, played basketball, and then got the opportunity to compete full scholarship Division I level, Liberty University, cross country, track and field. So went to Lynchburg, Virginia for 4 years.
Beautiful place.
Oh, man, the mountains. It's
still is beautiful.
Absolutely. My middle son was just back there with his dad about a few weeks ago, actually, and had a great time seeing it. So, but while I was in Virginia, I met my senior year of college. I met the man that I ended up marrying, and he was from Alaska. So
he went from Alaska to...
He played basketball, college basketball, went to the big dance, went to the NCAA tournament his senior year. So we met my senior year. He had one more year. I moved back to Charlotte. I coached. I worked at our church with youth, high school girls. And after he graduated, we moved then to Anchorage, Alaska. So I moved to Alaska in 94, September 20-something, 27th, 1994. We were married shortly after, and so I was there in Alaska for 20 years.
So why did you guys move back? I know he's from there, but
So
go live with mom and dad. I mean, like, what y'all do there?
No, I mean, think of it. You know, so he was a pretty prolific high school athlete and college athlete. So, you know, 94, 95, banking industry was really taking off. It was huge. He was a McDonald's All-American, Gatorade Player of the Year from a small town.
Yeah.
So he had a job waiting for him.
Sure.
And we were either going to go to Charlotte, which was super competitive banking industry, or we just kind of had the silver platter, you know, waiting for him. And we thought that'd be a great place to get started, do 3 to 5 years, and then move back to the East Coast. Well, 3 to 5 years turned into 20, as it often does.
Yeah.
So that's how I got there. And then I stayed. He and I ended up actually divorcing in 2003. And in 2010, he moved to North Carolina.
Oddly enough.
And here I am with three kids selling real estate by this
time.
In Alaska. And, you know, by then, my parents had moved to Briarwood in Birmingham in 99. It just made, I couldn't take my database of clients, and I didn't know anybody in Birmingham. I'd never lived here a day in my life. So, you know, I stayed and kept building a business and building a life.
So when you guys moved there, you freshly graduated from college. What did you start doing? He said he went into banking?
He was with a company called National Bank of Alaska, a local bank that eventually became Wells Fargo, several years later. So I had a college degree that, I had a degree in psychology.
Yep. High history, right?
Yeah, there you go. That's right.
Degree in nothing.
Useless.
A degree in absolutely nothing.
Useless without grad school.
Yes. Or you want to go teach.
Yeah, exactly.
That thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So the first 10 years, we had kids real quickly. We have three children. So I started doing temp work. I mean, I didn't know a soul. So I was doing temp work. I was doing this, that, and the other. And believe it or not, landed on working at a daycare at my church. Started doing the math, and anybody who's had children, you know, cost of childcare, and then, okay, cost of driving to work, getting another vehicle, work clothes, you're working to make nothing.
You're working for free.
You're basically working to come out on the other side a couple $100. So what we decided together, we would both tell you today, one of the best decisions we ever made was that I would put any career dreams on hold.
Yeah.
And not that I knew what they were. I had no idea. But I started working at our church's childcare center, which is large, 135 kids, 35 staff. So I got free daycare, but I got to be with my kids. So my oldest was 6 months old when we started there. By the time I left, my youngest was like 2 or 3. So I got to be mom.
You got to be mom there, but y'all made a little money on the side.
Made some money, didn't have childcare expenses, got to take him to school, even things as simple as I got to nurse my babies, you know, when they were babies and watch them take their first step and be fully present.
So tell me this is a question I always like to ask for everybody. middle school, high school, when someone came up to you, Jennifer, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Lawyer.
Really?
Absolutely.
Just because that was the answer, or did you like really have a...
No, I mean, we were raised, my parents were very intentional in parenting and really taught us, I think a hallmark of our, my brother and sister would say the same thing, a hallmark of our raising was they really taught us how to think. They taught us how to think, how to make the argument, how to defend our faith, how to analyze situations. Where do you see truth? What worldviews are you seeing, you know, in that movie or in this situation? And I love to make the argument. And so I really wanted to be an attorney. I felt like that was something I would be good at and I would get to argue for a living. So I got to college, took my first year, and it wasn't that I took a class or anything that challenged me. I just started thinking I really wanted to have kids and be a mom one day, you know, and I thought, man, like I'm going to have to not be around if I'm going to do that and be a mother and raise children. And I just didn't feel like it would fit into my life priorities. Yeah. And so I just dropped it at that point and then pursued a degree in psychology. And I took a bunch of stuff around speech communications, debate, public speaking, small group dynamics, which turned out down the road to be a degree in real estate.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really...
A lot of skills.
Right.
Okay, so we like to talk about parenting because what we do, business owners, there's a stigma behind being a business owner that you work a ton, you don't have a family, you're whatever, all those reasons. Mm-hmm. So you brought up something I love, and it's really similar with pastors.
Mm-hmm.
Pastors get pulled in a lot of different directions.
Sure.
I think that pastors, they work for 2 hours on Sunday.
Yeah.
But pastors get pulled at the odd hours. So your parents probably, I don't know for sure, but maybe miss games, things like that, because of being a pastor and having to go do be somebody for other people's families.
Right.
So what were the consistent daily things that your parents did with you and your siblings that made you like that? Because you were like, you were very quick. My parents were very ninja. So what were the daily consistent things they did with you?
So it's interesting. Answer that, but let me insert this first. After my father passed, my for those who don't know, my dad's a pastor of 5,000 member church here, was killed in a car accident, very sudden. He was 75 years old and was working full time, still running 80-hour weeks, you know, killing it. So my brother, who is the president of Birmingham Theological Seminary, decided to put together a fetch thrift in honor of my dad. Well, I didn't know what that word was either. I had to Google it. I also didn't know how to spell it. So a fetch thrift is a collection of essays. It's usually around an academic an academic theme. But this was a personal fetch thrift. So it's been picked up by Christian Focus Publications. It'll be out in July. Shameless plug. Yeah. It's called A Pastor's Heart. So there's 13 essays that have been written by independent authors, 13 men and myself. And so I wrote, along with Bruce Stallings, who is the executive pastor at Briarwood, probably spent more time with my dad than anybody else other than his family.
Yeah.
We co-authored the last chapter, which is A Pastor's Heart for His Family.
Mm.
And specifically, the book is designed for young pastors or not young pastors to get his philosophy, Christian education, missions, discipleship, leadership, worship, evangelism, all these different things. But part of it is his philosophy on his family and how did he parent as a pastor. So your question, I actually can answer that very clearly because I just finished writing a 5,000 word chapter on it.
Wow.
So they were very intentional around, they brought us into the ministry. So dad would grab one of us as kids. If he had to go to a hospital visit, Bible study, what you name it, if it was appropriate, we went with him.
I love it.
And we'd sit there and listen and learn and, you know, coloring and stuff like that too. I mean, but he was constantly teaching by example, by word. What did you learn? We just left that hospital visit. Yep. Let's pray for that person together in the car. They were super intentional around your time and what you did with it and how you used it for the Lord. So I would say that And to be honest, they did. My dad was actually my sister and mine, our running coach in high school. You said, you know, missing games and stuff. I do not know how he, the scheduling gymnastics he did to be at McAlpine Greenway Park in Charlotte, North Carolina, or the track that we would borrow from another school because Charlotte Christian didn't have a track then. But he was there all the time. I don't recall him missing anything. And I think that's kind of what formed, even in those early days when I had a job at a daycare, I wanted to be present the same way that my mom and dad were present for us. I don't recall them not being at anything that mattered.
So what I hear you're saying about this is he put you in the car and took you to the room.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be to the hospital to see someone that was sick, whether it be to a function.
Mm-hmm. Preaching engagement, you name it.
All those things.
Yeah.
So it's funny you say that because I try to do the same thing with my kids. Because I think that being intentional with your kids is important. But I think the days of sitting your kids down in front of a whiteboard and teaching them whatever the skill is, the thing you...
Yeah.
I just don't know that it's going to be applicable.
Yeah.
But like... A great example is last week I was talking to my kid. I have a 12-year-old, and my 12-year-old is extremely into this kind of stuff. My 15-year-old could care less.
Mm-hmm.
But my 12-year-old is extremely into finance and income and things like that. And he said, Dad, what's passive income? Mm-hmm. And I explained to him the difference between passive income and active income.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got a buddy, Rock Sandro, who's been on the podcast twice. He is in a group called Wealth Without Wall Street, and they talk a lot about passive income.
Yep.
And I said, I just put the phone on speaker.
Yeah.
I said, hey, Rock, explain y'all's passive income goal.
Sure.
And he just spit it out. He said, you know, first goal is to have your passive income equal 1 month expense.
Cover your bills. Right. The path.
He just went on. And it was a 7-minute phone call.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when someone else says it.
Oh, man, you're just a prophet like in your own backyard so as a parent. Yeah.
Cred when you say the same thing.
Right.
And so I love that because, I mean, here we are a little bit right around the same age, and your dad did the same. So it gives me a lot of, I'm happy to hear that.
Well,
that makes me feel good.
I think, and I know this isn't a podcast about parenting, but I think that we have, that culturally we've somehow come to this philosophy that quality time with my kids means an experience, a trip, an adventure, something set apart. And in this chapter that I wrote, I used the key verse was from Deuteronomy, you know, teach them when you're walking by the street, when you're, I think we bring our kids into our world and you're modeling work ethic. You know, we were taught work ethic by example because we were right there, you know, participating, to some degree in it. And I've done the same thing with my kids. You could call any one of them right now, all three of my kids, every time we buy an investment property, we make an investment into a business. I sit down with each of my kids and I say, let's go through the numbers. Here's this fourplex we're looking at. Here's the price. Here's the rents. Here's the taxes. Right. Here's the insurance. Let's do a cash flow analysis.
Yeah.
I want them to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
And as adults, they dig it. I mean, they love it. And so they can probably run cap rates and cash on cash return better than most seasoned investors because I just think you teach them as you go, and that's part of parenting is I don't have my business life over here and my family life here.
Yeah.
They have to be together.
They have to be together.
Otherwise, you send them into the world as adults just crippled.
Right.
And now they've got to learn everything the hard way. And I'll say, hey, these are three single families we're going to pick up as a three pack. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
Does this make sense? Tell me what you would do. And that is what was modeled to me. Mm-hmm. Now, not around real estate investing, but just around making decisions in life. And I had a really interesting conversation a couple years ago. Geez, Louise, 2008. Just the other day.
Yeah. 15 years ago.
It's fresh in my mind. Just happened. I got the privilege of being interviewed by Gary Keller, who's the founder of Keller Williams, the Keller and Keller Williams. I had just moved over as an agent. I was in Alaska. And, you know, when you get interviewed by Gary, they send you a list of questions, but then Gary just takes it wherever he wants to take it, and you just are along for the ride. And he says to me, he says, Jennifer, as a single parent, he said, do you struggle with feeling like you're really like present with your kids, or do you struggle with that? And I was like, well, yeah, you know, I've got the mom guilt and all the thing. I mean, I was selling a ton of houses. We were blowing and going, and technology at that time is not what it was today. So a lot of time was not leveraged out efficiently. Like, you didn't have DocuSign. You're not driving all over creation to get a signature.
Folders.
So yeah, 100%. And I said, yeah, I struggle with that. And he made a great point. He said, listen, he said, I just feel like you need to hear this. He said, if you go back into the like agrarian days of our society, when people farmed and they worked, now the kids got up in the morning and what did they do? They went and worked in the fields. Yeah. Then they came back, got ready, went to school, came home and did what? They worked in the family business to farm. He said, what were the divorce rates back then? What were the addiction rates? What were the, you know, all the negative things? He was like, I think bringing your kids into your work is actually a better job of parenting than keeping it separate and trying to live this compartmentalized life of I'm a parent here and I'm a business owner here. Yeah. And it really connected in my soul because A, I felt justified in what I was doing, but B, it made sense. And so my kids are the same way that I was. They've shown houses and been on home inspections and all the things. I mean, Mac, my youngest, was 2 years old. He was two when I got my license. And today, so he's 20, he's 23. My youngest is 23. So I've got 29, 27, and 23. And I have two stepdaughters, 24 and 21.
Man. So bringing your kids along, people use this term all the time, and I hate this term. And if you disagree with me, I'm sorry. Work-life balance.
I just think that's a myth.
It's a myth.
I think it's you're chasing a unicorn, and you're just going to keep chasing and chasing and chasing. You know, what I would prefer to say is work-life counterbalance. Yeah. You know, if I were to stand up right here and say I'm going to balance on one leg, and I stand and I lift up my left leg off the floor, am I balanced? Absolutely not. I'm balancing. You can feel it. You can feel it in your legs. Your muscles are making little movements and little pivots to keep you balanced. But you're not balanced. You are acting. You are verb balancing. Right. And I think that's parenting and business. I think you're constantly counterbalancing. There's times, there was a year back in Alaska, my middle son was in high school and he was really going through some just challenges. He's a senior. And I remember saying to my staff, guys, you're going to have to carry me. Because I got to swing this direction right now because this is important for life. And I need to, I'm going to come in a little bit later. I'm going to leave a little bit earlier. I'm going to do this, that, and the other. But as soon as you get through that shift, there's other times you lean in. You're like, listen, it's sleeping bag at the office right now. Yeah. This is what we got to do to pay the bills and to keep the fires burning.
No doubt. One of the things I'm hearing you say is, and this is what I think, because you probably went to a lot of practices and took your kids here. Don't piss away the time, even if it's 20 minutes with your kids.
Right.
It's like, for example, taking Tegan to wrestling. He wrestles downtown, which is 20 minutes one way.
Right.
Not far.
Right.
But there's 20 minutes one way.
40 minutes of talk time.
Concentrated talk
time. That's right.
And one of the questions we try to ask ourselves is not, how was your day?
Mm-hmm.
Bad question.
Yeah.
Tell me about your day. Now, Tegan will lay that sucker out. Jonna will kind of skim over it, but she's getting better. But tell me about your day. So that's extremely important for us, and it sounds like it was extremely important for
you. Well, my mother modeled it. You know, my mom cleaned houses all through high school and junior high to put us through private Christian education, and she'd pick us up. I didn't understand until I was an adult what she was doing, and same thing. She would never say, how was your day? You know, to a teenager, the answer is good, fine, good, whatever, okay. And she would say, tell me the best parts about your day today, or tell me the worst parts about your day. And it required an answer that was more than one word. And you know, it was years later, I realized what she was doing, but it was wise. It was very wise. And I remember saying to her, I said, why do you ask us that every day? And she said, because if you'll talk to me about the things that really don't matter, you'll talk to me about the things that do.
Yeah, sure.
And she was right.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so family was extremely important for you guys, you growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably going to take some thought. Tell me about the dinner table. Any rituals? Anything that your dad or mom...
Oh, 100%.
Okay, tell me about some. I want to hear these.
When we were small children,
yeah,
the dinner table was where after we'd finished dinner, I have very vivid memory of he would sit us up on the table. I'd sit up on the table and he'd sit in his chair. And there was where he taught me the Greek alphabet. That's where he taught me the catechism, the children's catechism. And he'd ask a question and I'd repeat it back. And it was a teaching space. And they did the same thing with my brother when he came along, did the same thing with my sister. So our table, the table is really, you know, it's funny with your what's the name? The owner's table. Yeah. Here we are. Yeah. And the table is sacred in our home, in my family today, in my sister's family, in my brother's family, in my parents' family. The table is where you linger. It's where you tell stories.
Yeah.
We pray around the table, all the way up until even now today. We've all pushed as we raised children to do what my parents did, which was intentionally be at the table together. As it gets harder, it gets scheduling.
We're hard right now.
You get in that teenage years, they got practices and conflicts. Yep. So what became the complement to that table was family worship. And that was never sacrificed. And it could be 11 o'clock at night. But growing up, we never missed a night. We had a curfew. And we didn't like that curfew very much when we became teenagers. We had 11 o'clock curfew, which was super early. You know, so terrible. I'd write whatever check I could write if I could go back to those days and do those devotion times again with my dad. But we ended every single night in their bedroom with sing song, read scripture, dad would give a little bit, and we pray together. And
every night.
And as we became, when we had friends over, they came with us into the room.
I love it.
I wrote in this book chapter, the Liberty University cross country team sat in my parents' room for family devotions. We were in Charlotte racing one time and we all stayed at my house. And my sister ran at Appalachian State. The Appalachian State cross country team did family devotions. It didn't matter who was there. That was what we did. And we did it together. So when we lost the ability to have a 6 o'clock dinner time, just based on life, we didn't lose anything.
That's wonderful. So as you're growing up, you wanted to be a lawyer. You transitioned into not being a lawyer.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that being a mom was the most important thing, which I think is wonderful. Kids start getting older, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Where does real estate come in?
Yeah. So kids start getting older, but more more succinctly, the marriage was not going well.
Okay.
So it was pretty clear that the Lord was going to have to do a miracle or we were not going to end up together.
Yeah.
And I knew that making my $10.50 an hour at the daycare, even with free childcare, was not going to provide for my family. But I was unwilling to sacrifice. See, I think, just to step back for a second, I think when we look at our lives and what we do with our lives, we have to understand that we have choices and we also have God-ordained roles.
Absolutely.
And when the Lord gives you children, that's a responsibility and a role that's non-negotiable. So I'm a mom, that's it, end of story. I am till the day that I die. So I wasn't really willing to sacrifice what I had, which was presence, the ability to go volunteer in the classroom if I wanted to, pick them up from school, just that flexibility. So I'm sitting here looking, what kind of career am I going to go into? I've got 10 years on a resume. By then, I was an administrator at the daycare, and I just didn't know what my options were with a psychology degree,
yeah.
You know. And I got a Christmas card. Remember back in the days when Christmas letters were a thing before social media, and you get your letter from your friend you hadn't seen all year, and they tell you all the things about their family.
Instead of just a picture with
it. That's right. That's right. And one of my girlfriends from college had gotten a real estate license, and I read it and I thought, maybe that. I didn't know a thing about anything, but it sounded like the three F's, freedom, flexibility, and financial opportunity. And I thought, maybe that's what I could do. And so I did some research, long story short, ended up getting my real estate license.
This just goes to show that you never know the impact that something small.
It was a sentence on a Christmas letter.
Is going to have.
Yeah, right.
So a sentence from a letter from a girl that you hadn't seen in over a year, however long.
Sure, yeah.
Send you a letter, and it prompted you into real estate.
We actually had that conversation, and in 2013, so I got my license May 10th of 2002. In 2013, five of us girls that were best friends in college got together at the beach in Florida. And I don't think I'd ever told her that. And I said, you know, I got my license because of your Christmas letter. She was like, what? She's like, I didn't even keep my license. Like, I got it and never did anything with it. And I was like it was nothing to her, but it changed the course of my life 100%. And so we had this kind of sweet moment of just sitting out at the beach, the five of us talking, and her being able to know that that little sentence impacted the actual trajectory of my entire life.
Family's life.
100.
All that.
All the things.
So you're an agent. Tell me about the agency days. How long were you an agent?
Sure. So I sold real estate. I started selling in 2002. And if you know anything about 2002, mm-hmm. if you couldn't sell real estate then, you should never sell anything ever in your life.
Good time.
You're ridiculous. Yeah. They're giving houses away. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know that that was unusual.
For now.
Yeah. Like, oh, it was like, a good time. It was a great time. So,
I bought my first house in 05.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was selling, started in 2002, a local independent company called Dynamic Properties in Anchorage, Alaska. Very well known, great, great broker, owner. I had taken care of her kids. They were her grandchildren that she raised. She had adopted her grandchildren. Were in my child care center that I worked at. It wasn't my child care center, in my church's daycare. And so that's where I went, hung my license there, and I sold 02 all the way through the end of 2010. So lived through the crash.
Good, real great time.
And then not real. And then that's right.
The recovery.
Yep, yep. So in 08, technically December 27th, 2007, Keller Williams had come to Alaska. There was not a Keller Williams there when I started selling. I didn't even know who they were. They had opened their doors in 06, and I was one of the top 10 agents in the state at that time. So they're recruiting me, and I'm like, guys, I think you're great. Y'all are awesome. I wish you the best. It ain't broke. Nothing to fix.
Sure.
Life is good. I'm selling houses. I've got no worries.
Why would I change?
No reason to change. Yeah. And then for Alaska, we felt the crash. Really, in 2007 is when it started. Like, my phone just stopped ringing. It was like someone just shut the water off. I mean, change happens suddenly or gradually and then suddenly. You know, you're in financial trouble at home, but it's not terrible. It's not terrible. Then one day there's a foreclosure notice. You know, your marriage is not great, not great, not great. Then, well, we're getting a divorce. You know, change happens gradually and then suddenly. And that's how it was. It happened on a dime. And so my broker, who I love and respect, I went to her. I was like, hey, you know, we need something. Like, I don't know, something. I need some training and I don't know what to do. And I just never had to work for business. My phone just rang, knew a ton of people. And I was a great phone answerer is what I was. I could answer my phone like a son of a gun.
Just watch.
Yeah. And once they came, once I got to them, it was great. Took care of them, loved them, great, good customer service. What I was not doing was making the phone ring. And I just didn't know there was a difference. So, I was schlepping spaghetti for 130 kids. And then one day I'm selling people's largest financial asset. You know, I didn't know anything. Ooh. And it's arguable today. I may still not know anything, but she said, you need to advertise more, you need to work harder, and you need to join the Chamber of Commerce. And I said, well, I just cut my $6,000 a month advertising budget with the newspaper, because that's what you did back then, because I don't have it. Yeah, yeah, remember that?
Guys, a newspaper.
You should define this.
A newspaper is what people would put on your driveway every morning.
That's right, that's right.
You went to work, you'd go out there, and you'd pick it up, and you'd read what happened the day before. That's a newspaper, kids.
Maybe even 2 days before. I mean, delayed gratification on the news cycle. So, you know, we take out all these classified ads and you'd pay for, you know, and then we had the real estate book. You remember the real estate book?
You were doing $6,000 a month?
Oh, yeah.
Gee, and that's a lot of money. Well, it was 15 years ago.
Yeah, it was a lot of money. It was a lot of money.
Almost 20 years ago.
But I was making it.
$6,000 a month.
Yeah. The real estate book. You remember the, you go to the little Cracker Barrel and you have to
sit right there.
Sitting right there. And so I had the first two pages were mine. And so that was all, you know, my little houses, little heads, you know, on there. And it cost a fortune, but you did it.
Had all the houses.
Yeah. Yeah, all my listings.
You would look at, I remember when I was, I'd remember looking at those.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody would pick them up and flip through them.
Oh, there's a house right here.
And of course, the houses are sold by the time it gets printed, but that was your marketing. So I, and there was no social media marketing.
Nope.
You know, there was no internet. I mean, I remember sitting in a sales meeting. I promise you, this is the truth. At Dynamic Properties, where we debated if a real estate agent should get a website, like debated it. Like, is this thing going to, like, catch on?
What about this internet?
This internet thing? Yeah. So so I said, Jackie, I got to cut that. That's gone. I've canceled all those contracts. The money's not coming in. I can't spend it out. Work harder. If you've got a deal with God that gets you more than 24 hours in a day, sign me up because I'll take it. But there is no work harder. I mean, I was working sun up to sundown, put the kids to bed, go back to the office, doing anything and everything I could to work. And joining the chamber, I mean, that's great. Love the Chamber of Commerce. Not going to fix my business today. So that's when I started, picked up the phone and called the guys that had been recruiting me and said, what do you have that I don't know? Turns out they had a lot that I didn't know.
Really?
Turns out Gary Keller had written the book on how to build a real estate business. And so they put me on a plane, flew me down to Austin, snuck me into a private mastermind with Gary Keller. I had no business being in that room. Top producers that are killing it in 08 out of Detroit, Arizona, Florida, the places that really just got hammered, right, by the crash. And they started talking about a database and systematically touching the database and how you make the phone ring. And it was like every light bulb. I didn't have a database. I had 19 sticky notes, spreadsheets, half built, a steno pad, my phone, but I had no collective database. And
how did you make the phone?
I can't tell you.
Yeah.
I just worked hard and people referred. I mean, people would say, we knew a lot of people. I mean, it's a small town, Anchorage, 250,000 people.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people. I was real involved in church and sports, had a lot of relationships, but just as you would do well, people would say, use Jennifer.
When they flew you down to this mastermind thing,
mm-hmm.
do you remember taking any knowledge, anything away from that?
Oh, like 97 pages. I'm just writing everything that I can possibly get. Because everything, I was a baby. I was literally a sales baby. I had succeeded entrepreneurially on natural gifts and abilities, hard work,
and relationship.
And that's it.
Yeah. Well, you had a good relationship there.
Correct. But the thing is that everybody starts in any entrepreneurial business. Everybody starts. They succeed to some level on natural gifts and abilities.
Yep.
But then you hit a ceiling and everybody hits one. So I had hit that ceiling and some of it was market imposed. I was either going to get out of it. So my choices at that point when I moved to Keller Williams was, I remember saying to my team leader, which is the role that I have today, I remember saying to him, if I don't have 15 houses under contract by the end of Q1, I'm going to go be a teacher. I cannot do this anymore. This is crazy. And I am not talented, but I am obedient. And they said, build a database. You're going to call through everybody. Here's what you're going to say, all the things. And I just sat down and did it. And it was a grind. It was administrative. I'm not administratively gifted. It's not natural. I don't have energy in that space. But I knew I wanted to stay in real estate because I didn't want to sacrifice what I had with my family.
Sure.
So I did everything they told me to do. And I remember March 31st at 10 o'clock at night, I inked number 15, went under contract. And I was like, all right, that's it, Lord. I'm all in. So I stayed in that role as an agent. It actually grew my business back. It had dropped about 60% in the crash, grew it back to what it was, plus some through 08, 09, 10. just by doing the right things. There, real estate's always going to be bought and sold.
Always.
MLS is never going to say zero.
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to open it up one day and go, oh my God, there's no houses to sell. No one is selling a house.
Mm.
I just had to find a way to get in front of the people that needed to buy and sell. So I stayed an agent through December 31st, 2010. And January 1st, 2011, I took the team leader, CEO role at Keller Williams Alaska Group.
Okay.
The guy that had brought me in, very close friend of mine, still is a friend, was moving, was taking an opportunity in Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Washington, right there at the river. And they asked me if I wanted to throw my name in the hat. And I said, I don't even like people. Why do you think I can run this office of people? And of course, I like people. Yeah. I'm just super driven, super focused. Yeah. And I just didn't think I was the right person. And worked through that and decided that it was the right opportunity, because what I realized was a couple things. Number one, I thought it was a great opportunity. Number two, I would grow as a leader. And number three, if I could hit a home run in this role, Keller Williams is a national company. Mm. I could get to Birmingham. I could find or get closer, right? So I hired someone to run my sales business there. So in our model, the team leader doesn't compete. We're not competing against our agents. That's right. That's right.
Okay.
And they're coming to us for teaching, training, consulting. They don't need to be worried about, am I going to go up on a listing appointment against the person that's supposed to be helping me grow my business? So I hired someone to run that. Failed my way through that couple of times, but got it to where it was running pretty good.
So when someone at this point, let me stop you. So at this point, if you're transitioning to from a real estate agent to a team lead,
mm-hmm.
in Keller Williams,
mm-hmm.
and Johnny, who you sold Johnny's, you're Johnny's guy.
Right, right.
Johnny's guy.
Right.
Johnny calls and says, hey, Jen, we're moving.
Yep.
I want to list the house.
Yep.
What would you do?
At that point, I'd say, this is fantastic. Listen, my partner, Jennifer Stalkup, I've taken this role here. I'm running the company. So what I'd love to do is, would you trust me to give you a person that's going to treat and take care of you the exact same way that I did? I'll be involved. I'll be on every single email. I'll know what's going on. You can call me for anything. But would you be okay with Jen Stalkup coming out and meeting with you? They're like, okay, if that's your guy, that's your guy.
Yeah.
I don't think one time did the handoff not work.
Okay, so you transitioned to this team lead role. So did you skip from an agent? Do you even go to a broker? Okay, so tell me what the difference in an agent, a broker, and a team lead is.
Yeah.
What you guys do.
So broker is a classification of license that the state issues you.
Okay.
So every real estate, in the real estate world, every real estate office has to have, by law, Alabama Real Estate Commission requires a qualifying broker. That person is legally responsible for the actions of all of the agents within that organization. I never wanted to have to put my license and my livelihood on the line if somebody screwed up bad enough. You don't get paid more to be a broker. Commissions are still negotiated the same way. There's no more money in it. And I felt like, why would I get a license that caused me more liability and didn't make me any more money?
Why do people become brokers?
A lot of people, I mean, it's a nice designation to have behind your name. Now, you can be an associate broker, which means you're not the qualifying broker. Aaron Sims is our qualifying broker here at Keller Williams Vestavia. He's phenomenally gifted at what he does a fantastic job. But I have a lot of agents that have an associate broker's license. It's the same license. They're just not in that position of liability for the office. A lot of people they feel like it makes them a stronger candidate when they're interviewing for, you know, competing for business with somebody else. There's more education behind it. I just saw the liability.
I know real estate relatively well.
You didn't know the difference.
I didn't know the difference. And I know Susie that's selling her house over in Mountain Brook doesn't know the difference.
People call me broker all the time. They do it all the time. And the only reason I correct it is if it's publicly something that's consumed by the public, I do want to be clear. I am not a broker. I have a salesperson's license.
So who is your broker over at Keller Williams, and why do they want to be that?
Aaron Sims.
Okay.
Aaron is my broker.
Okay, he is the broker.
Yep.
Okay.
So, and it really works amazingly well, because what happens is Aaron gets to be, first of all, he has a passion and a heart for helping agents, and he loves contracts. He loves understanding it. So he gets to be the broker. See, in a lot of companies, what you have is a broker who's also staffing, paying people, making sure the training calendar is built, and what happens at the front desk calls in, and there's toilet paper out in the bathroom, and handling this problem, that problem.
Most offices.
And they're also oftentimes selling their own real estate because the broker role doesn't pay anything. So it's a leadership role to be sure, and Aaron has a heart for it. So Aaron gets to handle earnest money disputes, contract issues, all of that. Now, does he tag me in all the time? Absolutely. You know, we consult together. My assistant team leader that works with me, her name's Catherine Singletary. She's my partner. She has a broker's license. So we talk a lot together. I've seen a few things. I've been around the block a time or two. And so we'll chop up how to handle this or how to handle this or that or the other. But he gets to stay solely focused on helping our agents through those issues and brings me in from time to time. And I get to focus on teaching, training, production, technology, attracting new talent, existing talent. And he didn't have to worry about all that. So he can be a better broker to his people.
How does he make money?
I pay him a salary.
Okay, he gets a salary.
Yep.
Does the broker in y'all's situation get any commission off of the houses? Let's just say, I know Anthony, I know Adam, I know he doesn't.
No.
So he is a salaried guy.
And Aaron does sell, in our model, he does sell some houses.
And he does sell.
Here and there.
When he has times.
When he has time, he does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so,
which I want him doing that because I want him knowing, I mean, the market changes minute by minute, things can change. And he needs to be in the trenches to a degree, not so much that it takes away from his ability to take care of our agents, but enough that he knows what's going on.
Right. Let's go back to the story.
Yeah.
You transitioned from agent to team lead in Alaska.
I did.
How long did you do that in Alaska?
3.5 years.
Okay.
So 2011, January 1st, until I moved to Birmingham, Alabama, I left May 28th, 2014.
Okay. So you leave there and come here. Did you leave that leadership role? It's called team lead?
Team leader.
Team leader in Anchorage to Birmingham. Did you come here and become the team leader?
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well,
it's like, I had timed it out.
Both my older two kids had graduated from high school, and my youngest was about to start ninth grade. So this was the time. It was either that or you stay for all my kids were in athletics. My son ended up playing football at Stanford. My daughter played volleyball. My youngest son was playing sports. So, you know, once they get into high school, you're either in it for 4 years, you know.
Absolutely.
So I had put the word out, you know, through, we have a lot of conventions, and I know a lot of people in the Keller Williams world, that I was looking to move to the East Coast to get closer to my family. And so I started having meetings with, and met with people from all different, Chattanooga, D.C., Denver, Sacramento. Birmingham actually came in hot at the last minute. I was about to accept an offer to take the same role in Chattanooga, which I would have been fine with Chattanooga. I lived on Lookout Mountain, taught us four. My dad graduated from Covenant College. My brother graduated from Covenant College. Great market, super close. I mean, it's a lot closer than Anchorage.
Right.
And at the last minute, Birmingham came in and said, we'd love to get you in Birmingham. The challenge there was the office was basically this close to shutting down. So Alaska was a very successful office. We were in the top 25 out of, at the time, 700 and so offices inside the Keller Williams world.
Wow.
We were closing $1 billion plus in volume every year.
That's nuts.
Super profitable, great agents, 317 agents. Life is great.
317 agents in a town of 250,000.
Yeah. With a board, I mean, there was only 1,200 agents in Anchorage, you know, to begin with.
So you had a third of them.
We had a third of them, yeah. Which is about saturation. You know, it's...
Wow.
So this opportunity came up here to take an office that had 44 agents. And
in a town of 1 million people.
In a big town. And basically had about 6 months of cash left. Had a difficult and challenging reputation. Of the 44 agents, 28 of them had full-time jobs that were not real estate. They're closing about 20 transactions a month. And I said, okay, let's do it.
Wow.
And took a massive pay cut. But the Lord had made it very clear to me through a series of events that I wanted to be in Birmingham with my family. And this move was not a career move, although I felt like there was a lot of, look, I wasn't going to break it. Like, I couldn't fail. It was already broken. So if I could put a sentence together grammatically correct, I probably would be all right. So I thought, let's see what we can do. So moved my family across the country. And came here and got to work. Didn't know a soul. I mean, I knew my parents. I knew a couple people that I would meet from time to time when we come down and visit and go to church, but I didn't know anybody. And nobody cared about my resume either. It didn't matter what I had done in sales or what I had done in the brokerage world. This is Birmingham and you're not from here.
Okay. In one sentence, how did you turn that Keller Williams office around?
Just did the basics consistently and intentionally.
Being very, very good at the very common things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's great. So give me that story of how that started and went.
Yeah, so got here and knew without a doubt this is where I was supposed to be. But, you know, I want it done now. So I felt like, oh, give me 6 months. We can get this thing righted. And it was more like 18 months, really. And so that was frustrating for me. But I kept dialing in, burned the ships. I mean, I literally sold every single thing that I owned. I moved here with my car packed. Like, it was like a house fire without the tragedy. Started all over. And began... Number one, started delivering the value proposition that our brokerage offers, which is training, technology, a great financial model for agents, and culture. So lots of training. I just started teaching and teaching and teaching and teaching on real estate, teaching on leadership, teaching on business, teaching on systems, teaching on processes, teaching on customer service, things that would help our agents go start selling more real estate if they executed. And begin recruiting. Now, this to me was first time in my life I've ever cold called. I've never cold called.
We had to, you know.
But I didn't know anyone. In my sales business, it was all relationships. When I became the team leader in Alaska, I knew every single real estate agent in this. Even if they weren't going to move to KW, we'd have coffee and talk. How's the kids? And how are your kids? And we just knew each other.
Right.
Here it was straight cold calling. And that was a challenge. So we started initially with a lot of brand new agents. We were able to get a bunch of brand new people. And I just thought...
Not in real estate.
Correct. Got their license and, oh, welcome to KW. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we kind of had to build our own stories of success through talent. And I will say my first 2 years, as I would begin to get appointments with existing agents, I was on kind of the Keller Williams Vestavia apology tour for about 2 years, you know, some things had happened. There was some bad blood, you know, hey, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. It's a new day. And everybody would say, yeah, there's been 8 team leaders in 8 years. So we'll see how you hang in there. So a lot of it was, I just had to give time. And I would tell people, look, time is a friend of truth. You're going to see, I'm not going anywhere. And after about year 3, I stopped apologizing.
Sure.
Said, we're done. We're new. We've got our own reputation. And so we gradually grew, dramatically grew, gradually grew. And so today, 10 years in June, we're at 475 agents. We largest real estate office, single office in the state of Alabama. Number one market share. So it's
10x'd in 10 years.
Yeah. I guess that's true. That's right. Wow. Profitable. Growing, thriving.
Yeah.
But we just had to deliver on the basics.
Be very, very good at the basic showing things.
Mm-hmm.
How does a team leader make money?
You're hired by the owners of the company. Okay. So I'm on a salary. Yeah. I'm on a very low salary, quite frankly. I am a bonus based on profit. So like as an entrepreneur would, I kind of went all in and just said, look, if y'all are going to make money, if y'all are going to do well, I'm going to do well. If we're not doing well as a company, I'm not doing well either. Like my eggs are in this basket with you. And then through the course of, you know, Keller Williams is all about developing entrepreneurs. So I've learned so much through the education and the training that KW provides. That's what has enabled me to start moving into, you know, I'm in the long-term rental business. I've got a couple of other businesses that touch. I know real estate. I don't know anything else. So I play in that sandbox, and anything that I've developed or worked on touches real estate because that's just what I know.
Okay. This is a question I ask all real estate people. Why is every real estate agent not a real estate investor?
I also ask that question.
Okay. So I'm glad that you have not answered for that. This makes no sense.
Fear.
Fear. Here's the answer I hear. Okay. Mm-hmm. And fear is right, but here's the answer. When I say, hey, Mary, why don't you invest mm-hmm. in real estate? The first thing that comes out of their mouth is, well, our income is just so inconsistent.
Right.
And I'm like,
yeah, but there's a way to fix that.
But you have a cheat code.
What we have would be insider trading in any other business.
That's it.
100%. 100%. 100%.
Well, it was like, for example, the first apartment complex we bought, mm-hmm. Crystal Odom, love her. She's a killer agent in Cookeville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And she's really the only one I knew that I really loved.
Yeah.
And I just said, hey, I want to buy an apartment complex. Can you help? Well, I've never done that before, but I'll do the best I can.
Right.
And so she started sending me any multifamily because apparently the day before it goes on listing, she gets it. I don't know if this is true or not true, but the day before it's listed, she would get it.
There isn't a system that does that today, but there's a lot of word of mouth that can happen.
Correct.
Right.
And so she would send me an email once a week.
Yeah.
Of like, this is either went on the market today, yesterday, or going tomorrow.
Right.
And for 6 months, I looked at everything.
Uh-huh.
And I'd say, no, ran the numbers, all the things you talk about what you do with your kids. And then I'd find one. Hey, let's go look at this one. Didn't like it. Hey, let's go look at this one. It didn't work. One day, I went and looked at it, and then we ended up buying it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you've got access to this.
And you're not doing it.
And you're not like, either figuring out how to use it.
Yeah.
Partnering with an investor that does have the
money. Do something
to develop something outside of your salary.
So I believe that brokerages, and I'll include everybody in this, we have failed the real estate agent because we've taught people how to make money, but we haven't taught people how to invest the money. And it'll be 3 years in September. So I turned 50 in June of 2021. And I mean, I'll just be super vulnerable, transparent, you know, went through, you know, divorced, this, that, and the other, took a step backwards, blah, blah, blah. Really don't have retirement.
Yeah.
And birthdays, like we're not big birthday people, our family. I mean, we celebrate and everything, but it's not like big deal. 50 hit me. No other year had hit me. 21 didn't hit me, 30, 40, none of that. 50 hit me. And I was like, dang. I need to get moving fast.
Wow.
So I went to my husband, and so the minute that I get something in my mind, I'm like, okay, now let's form an action plan. Let's sit down, whiteboard it out, get it put together.
Yeah.
What are we going to do? So I said, here's what we're going to do. I want to buy this many doors. Here's the math. We're going to not take any money out of it for 10 years. We're just going to pay down, snowball it. Ramsey, use the, let the tenants pay it off. In 10 years, when the mortgages are paid off, this is what we're going to have in passive income at 60. And he said, absolutely not. And I said, okay, tell me why. He said, I don't want to be a landlord. And I said, fair enough. You're not going to be a landlord. You're going to be an investor.
Yeah.
We're going to hire people. I'm not managing this property. Yeah. I don't have time.
I'm not going to fix toilets.
I don't have a, well, here's the catch. So everything I've ever done, I've done with a partner. I think partnerships help you get there faster.
They do.
With the right people.
Yeah.
With the right vetting, the right people, the right alignment, all that stuff. So I said, look, it's going to be you, me, and our business partner. He's bringing money. I'm bringing money. You're a general contractor. You're going to handle the maintenance. And
we're going to pay.
We're going to keep our expenses low.
Yeah.
Because you're going to handle the maintenance, the materials, and of course, right? But that's how we're going to do this. You're the secret sauce.
What did he say?
He said, are they going to call me? I said, no, the tenants aren't going to call you. You don't go in there. You don't tell them you're an owner. You don't tell them anything. You don't give me your phone number.
You're probably the fix-it guy.
So we got, and he said, I'm still not into it. And I said, great, no problem. Here's what I want you to do. I said, take 3 days. In 3 days, I want you to come back to me with a plan that shows me how we're going to have X amount of income monthly, passive income in 10 years. And when you give me that plan, if it's viable, we'll just do that. Well, there isn't another plan. There's not. So 3 days later, he's like, okay, fine. We're doing this. So we did and we started. And so what that bore for me, I'm a big believer. If you want to know something really well, you teach it. And I can't stand in front of a room and teach something if I'm not doing it, right? So we started 3 years ago, wealth building masterminds inside our office, our brokerage. So every single month, we get a group of agents come in and they're learning about investing in real estate. And I'm watching partnerships happen. I'm watching flips happen. I'm watching these agents, exactly what you're saying. I'm going, look, guys, you can generate great capital selling real estate. The question is, what are you spending it on and what are you doing with it? And how can you put it back into this field that we know and love and are passionate about and create generational wealth for your family? So that is, I think it's actually a hallmark of our office that number one, so many agents are now buying their own investment property. They're flipping deals. They're making mistakes. Yeah. They're learning, they're hitting home runs. They're learning, you know, you don't get it perfect every time. And we bring in different speakers or sometimes I just share, okay, here's a deal that I'm looking at. Let's underwrite this together. Let's just underwrite it right now. Let me walk you through the process, teach you how to do it. And that gets into all kinds of things. You know, that opens up the conversation around budget and personal budget and business budget. And what does a P&L look like and what tax strategies? And, you know, we talk a lot about cost segregation. We talk a lot about, you know, how are you paying yourself a salary? So that you just on and on and on, all the things. Every single one of them should be that. And so I think that, you know, I did it selfishly to hold myself accountable to doing what I know our family needed to do. And at the same time, I think it's been beneficial for all of our people.
When you turned 50, what was the goal? How many houses?
The goal is, well, with our partner, it's 80 doors in 10 years.
80 doors in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you at right now? We're four years into it.
We're at 10, probably be 18 to 22 very shortly.
So you're fixing them by a batch of them. Okay. Mm-hmm. So saying that, you are investing in single family?
Depends. We started with a really simple buy box.
Yeah.
A single family, we wanted them already rented. You know, we didn't know anything, right?
I'm going to ask this question again. As a real estate professional, how are you, quote, leveraging your insider trading as a real estate professional to invest for yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a couple different ways.
Okay.
One is obviously just MLS, watching the multiple listing service. I mean, I get paid to watch MLS all the time, right? Like I'm sitting there on it. Some people have to go to work and get a day job and they can't watch it all the time. But secondly is really word of mouth. So I've got 475 agents in our office. The number of deals that are done person to person that never come across the multiple listing service is insane. And a lot of those are not, you know, I want a home in Oak Mountain Schools, you know, in Mount Brook Schools, your traditional residential. It's, I've got an investor that needs to unload four houses, three houses, this, that, the other. And they don't want to go to market because they have tenants and they don't want people disturbing their tenants. So the insider trading honestly comes from the size of the brokerage because we have so many agents that are so productive. They're trying to move property and we're trying to look for property. And it's not just me. It's other agents that are, you know, taking advantage of those. There may be a deal that comes in today. I may not be in a position to move on that one, but hey, so-and-so down the hall is looking.
Adam and his wife are looking.
Right.
Thomas, I know Thomas Cox.
Right. Absolutely. So the insider trading is relationship driven.
Yeah.
It's just knowing people who are doing business because they come across this stuff. And honestly, our fourplex was we bought one property from a wholesaler met the owner of the property, not the wholesaler, bought that property. This guy had a fourplex that said, hey, I'd like to sell this. And we were like, okay, what do you want for it? So we went through that process and bought the... So it's not just single families. If it makes sense, we'll look at it.
Sure.
Period.
As a team leader, what's your... I'm going to back up a little bit. As a team leader, what's your major expense?
Personal or business?
Business.
Oh, salaries and rent.
Salaries and rent.
Sure.
How does the brokerage make money? Like Alex Keller Williams,
sure.
Vestavia make
money? So if you're an agent in my office, right, you sell a house and you've negotiated a commission from the buyer or the seller, however that shakes out, we take a percentage. The brokerage takes a percentage of that commission up to $14,000 a year.
Okay. So
what do you mean up to
$14,000? In other words, if you're selling houses... And I'm taking 20%, 20%, 20%. Once you've paid, I'll say me, meaning the house, KW Vestavia, once you paid KW Vestavia $14,000 in your fiscal year, if you've still got calendar left on that year, you're done with me. You keep everything till you reset.
Up to 14K, so you cap it.
You cap it, yep. So obviously the goal...
So if I pay you 14K... That means I can keep that 20%.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. So John Smith, the real estate agent, sells let's just say $100,000 home, $100,000 home. Mm-hmm. Can he negotiate his agent rate with that person?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's just
commissions are negotiable.
5%.
Sure.
So he goes 5%
mm-hmm.
from them. So he gets a $5,000 commission.
If he's paying him that on his side. Depends on how they're doing. It's all negotiable. Okay. Just had a big lawsuit about this, so I'm going to be very, very careful. Not us, nationally. Be very careful how I say this.
The commission.
Yep.
He splits it with...
Let's say he splits it in half. Gives the buyer...
$2,500.
Yep. Sure.
He makes $2,500, but he has to pay the house...
Yep.
20% of that number?
So, $500.
But when he hits 14K to your place...
It passes through. Zero.
He doesn't pay that 20%?
No, we don't take.
How many of your agents... cap out at the $14,000.
157.
Oh, my stars. You're killing it. That's great. It's a testament to you.
Yeah.
So if 150 agents are hitting the $14,000, that's pretty good income for the house.
It pays the bills.
Yeah. Okay. So you got 150 agents. That is a 24 to 30%. No, 20, 30, a little over 30%.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
It's nationally, let me tell you how bad Keller Williams was, Vestavia, when I got here. No other company in Birmingham that I'm aware of, there may have been one small one here and there, had a cap. So I'm interviewing agents, and I'm like, look, man, I can save you $75,000 a year. And they're like, yeah, but we really love our broker. Like, you got to be bad.
$75,000 a year?
Oh, yeah.
They're saying no?
Yeah.
So some of these places are paying $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year to their broker.
Oh, and more. Sure. Now, the cap, as competitive environments change, you know, we started being successful. And so, you know, I jokingly say, you know, every agent gets a raise when Keller Williams is successful, no matter where they are, because all of a sudden, people come meet with me, have me give them a financial model. They go back to their broker and renegotiate their deal, which, I mean, I know that that's what they're doing. And I would say, hey, if you're not going to come here, go get yourself a better deal. And they would. So that the landscape has dramatically changed in 10 years, for sure. It's much more competitive now. At the same time, a brokerage can't exist and it'd be free.
No.
For agents to work. I mean, you have to provide a service to the agent.
Okay. What's the number one piece of advice you would give a new real estate agent?
Understand what your job is.
What is that?
To generate leads. Your job is not to sell houses. That's a byproduct of doing your job. Your job is to find buyers and sellers, and then you get to sell them houses.
So real estate agent's number one job.
Generate
leads.
Mm-hmm.
Find buyers and find sellers.
Yeah.
I've never heard it said.
It doesn't matter how great you can write a contract. If I don't have a client across the table, it's a useless skill set.
Yeah.
So I have to find. And see, that's the misunderstanding. People go, I want to get in real estate. I love HGTV. I love looking at houses. there's no secret list of buyers and sellers that we say, well, here's your book of business. Here's your clientele. Every agent has to build, they are business owners. And I say that very clearly to our people. You own your own business. And see, when I told you back when we talked about my story, and I said I was a great phone answerer, I was. And I was very, you know, Jesus just took care of me. Like, that's really was my business plan. God has a soft spot for me. But I didn't know how to generate leads and make the phone ring.
Yeah.
That's what I had to learn. And then we get to sell homes. That's the consequence of doing your job, which is to find buyers and sellers.
I'm giving you unsolicited advice. You need to start, I don't know if you're doing this now, start a platform or start a something where you're teaching people in your position how to invest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because again, you have an insider trading. I mean, love when you said that. That's a great way to say it. Yeah. You have an insider. I think all real estate agents.
I mean, it'd be illegal if we were anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know?
But like, you have a cheat code.
Yeah.
And you starting something where you're teaching those people, I think would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. Okay. Closing down here.
Mm-hmm.
If you lost everything today,
mm-hmm.
and all you had was knowledge and relationships,
mm-hmm.
and you had to start from zero,
mm-hmm.
what would you do?
Same exact thing I'm doing now. I just started over. Start from scratch. And probably do it better.
If you were, if you were a new agent,
mm-hmm.
what's your first 90 days looks like?
Yeah. Your first 90 days is building that database. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things. Number one, you're sitting down with your phone. You're sitting down with your directory from church. You're looking at and you're making a list. I don't care if it's like a notebook with paper. Best to be in Excel, name, address, phone number, email, any piece of data you can build. Think of it this way. Dentist sells a practice. What does a dentist sell? The book of business. That's their database, right? Same thing. So you build your database. Everybody you know. And I hear people say this all the time. They're like, well, that person just bought a house, so they're not going to buy one again. Some of my best clients never bought a house from me or sold a house with me. But they referred tons. I think immediately of a friend, a past client, or a database person in Alaska, never, ever, ever used me for real estate. They had inherited a family home. They were never going to leave it, and they still have not. But they sent me so many friends and family. Oh, you need to buy a house? Call Jennifer. Oh, so people in your database, it's people you know who you can create raving fans that are out there telling your story. Build a database, preview 50 homes a week. Now, 10 of them, you should get inside.
You say preview, drop
go, off. Go walk through it. Well, 10 of them, you should get inside. Go to agent open houses. Go to open houses. Set up vacant property showings to see houses. Don't disturb a seller and make them get out of the house if you're just looking. But that's how you get educated to the market, mm-hmm. very quickly. 40 of them, you can look online. Look at the pictures and then just watch it. I can get educated. I could move to Meadow Muffin, Minnesota tomorrow and spend 90 days and I can know the market inside out if I did that. So educate yourself to the market and then talk to 10 people a day and just tell them, hey, I'm in real estate. This is what I'm doing. If you ever know somebody who's looking to buy or sell, man, give me a shot. So that's the first 90 days.
I love that. How can a new real estate agent leverage the MLS?
Yeah. So the best way they can leverage the MLS is to utilize a free tool, right? Mm-hmm. Facebook is free.
Okay.
Instagram's free.
Yeah.
All of it's free. Go preview houses, get online, start showing video, show pictures, start talking about properties that are for sale.
And you find those properties by being on
looking MLS. On MLS.
Looking on MLS.
Live in it.
Doing a
preview
doing
it. 10-minute radius. That's right.
These are the 12 houses. Go see all 12 houses.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Perfect. Jen, this has been one of the best episodes I've done in I don't know how long. So tell me this. If someone wants to get in touch with you, whether they're in Muffin, whatever, Minnesota, or Birmingham, Alabama,
sure.
How do they find you?
You can find me on Facebook. It's super easy because I have a lot of last names. Jennifer Reeder Toomer Hay.
Oh, wow.
Very easy to find. Yeah. Or Jen Toomer, JennTOOMER@KW.com.
Perfect. Jen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.